So the, you know, so I think we, I'll go quickly through the preliminaries, because I think we've heard many of these things many times in the last couple weeks. So what are the ingredients at the mesoscopic level that go into these models for elastoplastic yielding? So we believe that fundamentally we have some particles, we're pushing on particles, the particles do some rearrangements, they redistribute stress. What kind of assumptions go into mesoscale models? So first of all, there's some questions about what is Eshelby, and you know, some people when they say Eshelby, they mean Coulomb, and some people when they say Eshelby, they mean Eshelby, right? So we'll go through and we'll figure out what the difference is there. So how you incorporate the mechanical description of the material, there are basically three different categories of ingredients that need to stick into these models. How do I describe the mechanics and the stresses and the response? How do I make things stochastic by driving or putting in disorder in some kind of clenched way? And then how does the system evolve? Do we have some kind of deterministic procedures for evolving the system? Do I allow for inertia in the response? Do I put in damping? If I put in damping, how do I put in the damping? And you know, so if it's stochastic, which degrees of freedom does the driving noise act on? And so these may or may not be important issues, but I would like to explain to everyone clearly how these things are put into the mesoscale models. Okay. So if your name isn't on this list, please don't feel sad. Don't be mad at me. I tried to make it comprehensive, but it's a very long list of people over the years that have made contributions here. I think starting back with Bulatov and Argon in 1994. And more recently, Eric Homer, who is Chris Hsu's PhD student, who's now in Utah with David Rodney, have been doing some work along these lines with a model that's directly inherited from Bulatov and Argon. Damien and company have pushed forward some other models that are related that I'll tell you in detail how they are similar and different to Bulatov and Argon's model. And there are various extensions of this basic idea that have been put forward in the last couple of years. There is a paper by Onuki that has really been undercited, and I think that's very disappointing. It was very important for me in formulating my thinking about how this stuff works. And so I'd like to remind everyone about this paper by Onuki and his approach and what ingredients he puts in. Then there have been the models by Lederich Bouquet, Armand Ashari, and company. And then finally, an approach by Hagla that's related most directly to Onuki's approach with some slight differences. So if you put up the grid here, right, so these are the names, right, so there are five basic flavors from the previous page. And in these three categories that I think are the important ingredients for constructing these models, what are the primary degrees of freedom in the system that I'm keeping track of, that I'm poking, that I'm counting and accumulating? So we can have discrete flips, like in a Bulatov kind of model, where I say plasticity happens in a discrete way. Or we can have a continuous potential energy landscape where the system evolves continuously. So these are basically automata, and these are basically a large set of coupled ODEs, the Onuki version and the Hagla version, whereas these other three flavors, you basically have some kind of a automaton, something flips, right? You keep track of discrete numbers of flips. Yeah.
Can I ask, because I'm not in this field.
Yes, sorry.
So elasticity, is this due to some kind of elastic forces, or is it of entropic order origin, or?
We'll come to it, and I'll be very precise about it in the next slide. Okay. So class one, you know, how am I thinking about the mechanics at the level of individual elements in the material? Point number two, if I think about the landscape, either the quenched or the dynamically evolving landscape that local zones in the material are subject to, right, I can either choose those thresholds from some kind of distribution, or I can choose uniform thresholds. I can redraw the thresholds dynamically as my system evolves. Or I can put in a very, from the beginning of the simulation, I can put in a very disordered but continuous landscape that the local strains live in as they evolve, right? So I can either put in something uniform, I continuously redraw as I go, or I can stick in something continuous but random, okay? And then the last piece,
what,
I think, that's important.
The,
yes.
What about
yes.
the stress after the plastic event? Where does that fall? So you have some plastic yeah. event, and yes. the stress can.
So I would lump that into column one. So how is the notion of force balance or stress equilibrium maintained during the simulation? So I put that in category one. right? So if you're asking about the question of how dynamically are stresses transferred from one piece of the material to the rest of the material, I'll lump that into sort of category one, right? And so within these, you know, gross characterizations, there are sort of sub-distinctions there, right? In how I actually compute those stresses.
So it's so you're saying that is sort of saying how you relate stress to strain? Is that?
So in these models where there is
an elastic.
Exactly. So in these models where there is a discrete event, there's a question about temporally and spatially, how is that stress redistributed? Okay. And so I'll talk about how in these five different kinds of models that is different. Okay, and then for the last category, how does the system evolve? So I can either evolve the system by thinking of some kind of strictly activated processes, right? So in the model from Bulatov and Argon, it's really built on kinetic Monte Carlo, which is really like, it's in the same spirit as the SGR model, right? There's always some kind of hopping, right? Things are not driven over barriers. Whereas some of these other setups, so for instance, the Barré setup, I would say is closer in spirit to the Heber-Lequeux model that we heard about yesterday, where once you hit a threshold, something happens, rather than having an actual activated process being a crucial ingredient, right? So in this flavor of elastoplastic model, the activated process is crucial and it drives everything and it gives you the time scales, right? So all the time scales in the problem come from the time it takes to jump over a barrier. Okay, and then we can have these extremal kinds of dynamics, which I'll talk more about, but we've already heard at this meeting from Damien, where you push the system till it hits threshold, you flip something, okay? And then a related kind of flavor are the class of models from Ajdari, Bouquet, and co-workers, where you have a threshold process plus something stochastic in terms of how long it takes once a local site is over threshold to do something. And then finally, we have an approach from Hagla, which is very similar to Onuki's approach, where you have some kind of noise driving the system continuously in time. And he also has a relaxational dynamics that makes his model unique and separate from the other four that I'll talk more about when I get to trying to describe what it is that he's doing. Okay. So questions about the basic setup, the three ingredients that I think are important, five different flavors of models. Okay, so let me go into a little bit of detail and describe what Bulatov and Argon did in 1994. And so in my grid here, so the primary degree of freedom, it's some kind of automaton. I'm something plastic will happen in a discrete way. The thresholds that a local site sees are uniform. They don't change with time. I always have the same thresholds, and I'm doing really a kinetic Monte Carlo kind of simulation. So this goes back to Thomas's question, what do I mean by elasticity and how is the elastic information propagated through the system? So this goes back to Eshelby, who, Jim Langer always reminds us, was at Birmingham and rode the bus with Jim back in the day. But anyways, okay.
Is that important?
I don't know, is it important? I don't think there was any influence on Eshelby during those days, or maybe, okay. Okay, so anyway, but I think this is really a very clever mathematical problem that he solved. So the Eshelby problem, it goes like this, right? So I have some kind of elastic solid. It may be loaded at some stress level. I cut out an arbitrarily shaped region in the interior. So Eshelby actually was able to find closed form analytical solutions. If this region was elliptical, I don't think that's particularly important for our purposes here. And the idea is this. So you cut out the region, right? You then say, I'm going to take this region that I just cut out and give it a different stress-free reference state than it had before. Okay? And so the difference between the old stress-free reference state and the new stress-free reference state in terms of strain, that's called an eigenstrain. Then what you do is, subject to this new eigenstrain, you allow the system to assume its new stress-free shape, which will not be the shape that you cut out of the matrix. You put on tractions to put it back into the shape that it was in the matrix, right? You stick it and you weld it together, so you solve then a new problem, which is a no-slip, you put a no-slip boundary condition on the inclusion, and then it will come to yet a new shape where those tractions you put on the surface to squeeze it back into its initial shape come to equilibrium with the surrounding material. Okay, so it's roughly analogous to a problem in electrostatics where I have some piece of the material that has a different dielectric constant than the rest, and Eshelby was the first person to solve this for elasticity. And so in general, if you have a complicated shape, the near field response could be complicated. And Eshelby showed how to solve this problem with some kind of integral convolution technique, where you have a kernel, and the thing that you're convolving is the local value of that transformation strain that takes you from the old reference configuration to the new reference configuration. Okay, and so what Bulatov did, he took this very seriously, and he discretized his space into this honeycomb lattice. And each of these cells, what he computed, subject to this whole this hexagonal chunk being embedded in a uniform elastic medium, okay, he took the free space Green's function for the Eshelby problem, and he integrated over each one of these little hexagons, and he found out, if I imagine each one of these hexagons undergoes some kind of Eshelby transformation, what is the average stress that I induce on one of the other hexagons? Okay, so he did this once, he tabulated it, and he used that stress in his kinetic Monte Carlo procedure. Okay, so is everyone clear on what Eshelby is, what kind of calculation Bulatov had done? Okay, why it may or may not be important relating to other things later.
So this gives this one over r to the power b k.
In the far field.
Yeah.
In the far field. And Eshelby solved it in full generality. He found the displacement fields in the matrix and in the inclusion, right? And so the stresses are continuous across the interface between the matrix and the inclusion, but the stress derivatives have a jump.
But I don't understand this.
Yeah.
I mean, this model, I mean, yes. You have these hexagons, yeah. So they are made of atoms or?
Some set, okay, yes. So this is a, it's a model, so you can take it for what it's worth. The idea is that this is some region that encompasses many, a handful of atoms, right? So I think Jean-Louis' picture, you know, he showed us a cartoon of some bubbles, maybe a region that's 10 bubbles by 10 bubbles, okay, in a phone, something like this, roughly. Okay. But the point is that in this model, any tile in space may undergo plasticity, right? So if you want to call these sites in space shear transformations, that's fine. The important point is that in this model, any site in space is a potential shear transformation. So in some sense, they're dense, they're large, they touch each other. Okay, what else do I want to say? So so of course we need to assume that we're using the version of elasticity theory that's small deformations, because if we don't use small deformations, these hexagons won't be able to properly tile space because they'll have strains that are incompatible with each other. Okay, so the dynamics that he does is a kinetic Monte Carlo, and what he says is that when I have a transformation, what he's saying is that the rate of transformations at the nth tiling into the alpha state, and so he pre-selects six different transformations. So I can have a transformation where I undergo extension along the horizontal axis, extension along this axis, extension along this axis, sorry, extension along this axis, extension along this axis, and extension along this axis, right? So six possible directions to have.
Discrete? Can you go a continuous amount in those, or is it?
No, so for any one of these sites can undergo one of six possible plastic transformations, right? And it's a volume preserving, area preserving transformation, and you can extend along any one of these 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 axes. And contract in the other direction to preserve area. Okay, and these are the six transformations that for each one of these lattice sites, he computed the resulting stress coming from a detailed Eshelby calculation on each of the other tiles in the system. Okay.
There's a dilation,
so there's a transitory, so he assumes that there's a barrier state, right? So he assumes that there's a barrier state that involves some shear and some dilation. And when he uses elasticity to compute the transition rate in here, okay, so this epsilon star corresponds to the strain in the on-barrier configuration at the site that's potentially undergoing a transformation, okay? And so he contracts that with the strain, I'm sorry, he contracts that strain at the barrier with the stress on that site to get something to subtract off from the free energy to get something to stick up there as a rate factor, okay? So there's some transitory dilation that's allowed, okay? But the dilation comes along, pretty much comes along for the ride. If you put this thing under large hydrostatic pressure, Because of this, because of the fact that this thing contains some dilatancy, you're going to suppress the overall transition rates. Okay.
Why honeycomb and not squares?
I'm sorry?
Why not squares, but honeycomb and some, yeah?
He could have done, yeah, so when I asked him about this, he always made it clear that in his mind, he could have done squares, and we'll look later. Onuki's model is essentially a continuous version of the Bulatov model, where the transitions that are allowed are still these six transitions, but the discretization in space is on a square grid. So I don't think it's particularly important that this is on a triangular lattice. Okay. All right, so what else do I want to say? So you have an expression for an energetic factor that comes into the transition rates. And so this factor, he has a bare free energy barrier. And so that's a parameter in his model that basically gives him an unbiased transition rate going from one of these states to a barrier in the absence of any loads. Okay. So what else do I want to say? So there is no quench disorder. Everything comes from the stress inhomogeneities that come from a pre-existing set of plastic transformations that's either been put in by hand or you can get from quenching from high temperature. Okay, so there is no quenched in disorder per se. And so just since, you know, we've been talking this week a lot about the sociology of science, I think this paper is very interesting. So I don't, you know, Daniel's not here, but I'd love to know what he makes of this. So for the first 5 years, this paper had no citations other than a self-citation 4 years later. And then in 2000, it was cited by some Falk and a J.S. Langer in an MRS Bulletin review. And then after that, the citations kicked up, and now it's at 113. Okay, but so you can take that for what it's worth. And some of the results that you can get out of a model like this. So there was one paper where they explained the basic model, and there were two other papers where they went through some of the results. In paper number two, they weren't putting on any load. They were just looking at what this thing did spontaneously at finite temperature, and they observed what they identified as a proper glass transition, at least the kinetic glass transition. So at high temperatures, if you look at the energy as a function of temperature, as they bring the temperature down at different cooling rates, the system arrests at different energy levels, right? If you cool quickly, it arrests at a high energy. If you cool a little more slowly, it arrests at a lower energy. And you can see this is a completely, in some sense, it's a completely kinetic glass transition, at least at these temperatures, because if you cool slowly enough, they can get a completely relaxed system. And they showed that if you look at the stress autocorrelation function, the stresses decay in a non-exponential way as you get lower in temperature, and you can imagine this might be related to some kind of supercooled liquid behavior. They did not look seriously at the rheology in this high temperature regime, but they did look at these sorts of effects. They looked at memory effects like the Kovacs effect. So if you do a direct quench, so this curve up here is what you get. This is the energy as a function of the log of time. If you quench from high temperature down to a temperature of 0.7, which is still above their glass transition temperature, but when it's behaving in an anomalous way in terms of the stress relaxation. On the other hand, if you run a glass at 0.4, yeah?
Sorry, I'm just trying to figure out the vertical.
This is energy. This is just the internal energy as a function of the log of time. Okay, and so if you anneal the glass at 0.4 for a long time, then you jump up to the same temperature. What you see is that the energy hangs out at a plateau for a long time. Then it goes up over some kind of barrier and it comes back down. Right. So this is something that you see often in experiments and molecular simulations on glasses. Okay, and then so in paper three, they were worried more about loading, and they could start from an ordered solid. And in the ordered solid, you're basically nucleating dislocations. The dislocations become entangled after the dislocations are sufficiently entangled. It looks more or less like a glass. Or you could start from a quenched glass or an annealed glass. And so the point is, when they started from an ordered solid, they would see a very strong overshoot, then a relaxation back to a plateau at some temperature and strain rate that aren't terribly important. on the other hand, if you look at a quenched glass, there's no overshoot. You're in a highly disordered state, and the stress rises this is the stress versus the strain. So the stress is rising monotonically with strain. And you get basically the same sorts of things that we see in molecular simulations when you quench very rapidly. So there's no persistent localization. You see transient localization, ephemeral lines of slip. So for instance, this is, and then if you anneal your glass, Then you can get something intermediate. You can get a mild stress overshoot and a relaxation. And during the time when you're softening over here, you do see some kind of more than transient localization. So there's some localization that persists over some time. Okay, and this is certainly related to the shear bands that people have been talking about here at this program. Okay, so that's just to show you.
Yes.
This is two-dimensional. Two-dimensional. Okay.
How do you accumulate the practice training of this moment? Each time that a critical successive in the same direction.
You can have as many transformations in one direction as you want, right? And so this could be, so if you just shut that off and you only allowed one transformation, it would be very much like a model people use for Martin sites, right? So you have one transformation and then it's exhausted.
You don't have any real
I'll put the model back
there. The plastic deformation to change the boundaries of the system.
It's all kinematically linear and it's all in small deformation framework, okay? So take that for what it's worth. Right. But you can certainly have repeated plasticity along bands that can go ad infinitum. Okay.
What were the boundary conditions?
So the boundary conditions, this thing is embedded in an elastic continuum. Right? You can think about this thing as being embedded in an elastic continuum because when he went in to carefully do the integral convolution to figure out what the stresses were here due to a plastic transformation there, he used the free space Green's function for the Escherby problem. Okay. So implicitly that means the whole thing is embedded in a free continuum that's at some stress somewhere at infinity. Yeah.
If I would just take a triangular lattice and I allow for dislocations, give them a low energy, and I load this model, so would I get the same results in principle, or is it something missing in this?
So somehow I think if you had a triangular lattice, right, and you loaded it and you allowed the dislocations to form, as it got to a more and more disordered state, the set of transformations available to it, I feel like they would change. And so I'm a little bit confused. This is a discussion. It's okay for me to be confused, I guess. I'm confused because in this model here, it seems like you get glassy behavior despite the fact that you're always stuck with these six possible transitions, right? Whereas in a real triangular lattice, as you shear it, the dislocations become entangled, it starts to look more and more like a glass. I think the behavior would be, you know, richer than this, right? So even though we're throwing out that realism, you know, this gets a lot of glassy phenomenology out of it. I don't know, do other people have thoughts?
Entanglement dislocations in two dimensions is not as dramatic as in three dimensions, right? Because they are just...
So when you start from a completely ordered state, right, what you see initially is you're nucleating pairs, the pairs sort of glide apart, but pretty quickly after that, once you get past the stress peak, it's hard to look at the local plastic strain and, you know, say anything different, note any difference between the, you know, the ordered solid and the, you know, any of the glasses. So I'm not, you know, that's in this
one. What do you mean by entanglement of dislocations in two dimensions?
Obstacles form. Okay. These things block. Okay.
The Beta factor is always uniform distribution.
Yes. So every site, you know, it can do one of these six things, and given its stress, this activation factor is the stress on that site times each one of those six things. So those are my possibilities, and those give me the six different rates for that site.
And those renew after plastic event, or?
There's no renewal per se. I mean, it's always, so once you have a plastic transition, you recompute the stresses everywhere. Each site will have a different value of sigma average on it by virtue of the plasticity. And then there are six possible transitions that site could make. And this gives you the rate for each of those six transitions. No, there's no randomization of any, there's no randomization of a threshold, right? So there are six different values of this epsilon star. And you compute what sigma is at each site, right? That gives you the six different barriers. Mm-hmm. Okay. So I think it's, you know, in the list of ingredients, I think it's intrinsically different than something like a model in Damien's class where you're redrawing the barriers, right?
That's what I'm trying to understand, yeah.
Okay, so that was Bulatov. Now on to one of my favorites, because it's the underdog and no one really cites this paper, but I like it a lot. This is Onuki's paper from 2003. And so if we look at the chart, the displacements are continuous. It's not an automaton, right? I have real elasticity. I have propagating elastic waves in the material. And those may or may not be important for what happens. The landscape, the local landscape, is a continuous version of Bulatov and Argon, right? So it's virtually identical to Bulatov and Argon if you ignore the fact that I can talk about nonlinear elastic behavior in this model, in the sense that I have six possible transitions that are available to me. Okay, so what Onuki does, he basically discretizes space. Now, you know, Tomas asked before, asked if the triangle lattice was important. So now we're on a square lattice, and what we do, each of the nodes here has a velocity or displacement, and then I can, just by taking finite differences, associate a strain with each plaquette, right? And so I have an energy based on those strains, and the free energy is uniform everywhere. The free energy is a function of the strain. So I have essentially, if I take away rotations, I have three different strains. I have a volumetric strain, and then I have two shears, right? So I can have shear along the axis of the box, and I can have shear 45 degrees away from the axis of the box. And if I write down a free energy landscape in terms of these two shear strains, if you write down something with six-fold symmetry, it means that I have six transitions available to me. Okay, and this is what Onuki did. I can go from a circle to an ellipse extended along the 45-degree line, and then I can rotate the extensional axis by 30 degrees, going from here to here to here to here to here to here. So this is the Bulatov and Argon picture rotated by 30 degrees, right? The possible transformations that are allowed. Okay, so where is, so I write implicit Eshelby, right? Where is Eshelby coming from here? So Bulatov did a very painful calculation to compute what the average stress that was induced at a remote site after transformation at one site over there. That comes essentially for free in Onuki's framework, right? So by the way he's discretizing space, he's basically enforcing elasticity. He has a compression modulus and a shear modulus that come into the local free energy. And then, for instance, if I were to go in, and at one of the sites, one of the plaquettes in my system, if I were to force a shear and make a jump from this configuration to that configuration, and then I ask my system at zero temperature come back to force balance, that would induce stresses. I would move away from the zero of the free energy in all the other sites, right, in the way that you would expect. So if I put a forward shear, the site that I transformed, it would be pulled back very strongly by its neighbors to the original shape, and its neighbors would be pushed in a way from their centers over towards the configuration where I just pushed this local plaquette, right? So in that sense, that's what I mean by Eshelby coming for free.
I'm confused.
Yes.
How are the degrees of freedom? You have the elastic field.
I do. The degrees of freedom are the displacements on the nodes. I have an energy, and so I'm coming. Let me come to that down here. Okay. So I just explained. So the transformation symmetries are identical to Bulatov, right? So basically, each site, each of the plaquettes, roughly speaking, can do one of six things, like in the Bulatov model. The lattice is incommensurate with the symmetries of that of those transformations. I don't think that's particularly important. Bulatov didn't think that was particularly important. And then so now the dynamics, right? So I just write a force balance equation, right? I allow for inertia, right? I'm not necessarily taking things to be overdamped. So the first term here is the divergence of an elastic stress, which is just basically my local free energy derivative with respect to strain, right? So at each site, I have a free energy derivative with respect to strain. That gives me a stress. Then I take a divergence of that. And these are all done using two centered finite differences on the lattice.
What is V?
V is the velocity of one of these nodes of the lattice. Okay. Okay, so all I'm doing is writing F equals ma for each node on the lattice after I discretize things, right? So where the force is coming from, there's an elastic force that comes from this free energy landscape over here. There is a viscous force that just comes from the standard. I'm taking a divergence of the gradient of the velocity. And then there is a random force, and this is another ingredient that I want to point out. We should talk later and try to understand whether or not this is important. So he's forcing the stress. He's not forcing the force. So the Langevin equation, the driving term of the Langevin equation, is on the stress. So it's white noise on the stress, which means it's going to, because of this divergence here, it's going to be colored on the node by one factor of Q, which may or may not be important. Okay, but that's an ingredient of his model. And then so I just have F equals MA.
And so I was just saying the Escherby transformation field comes for free,
and it may or may not depend on how the elasticity is discretized. What he's chosen to do here is to solve these expressions he's done to centered finite differences.
And nonlinear term and velocity, like in Euler expression?
All kinematically linear.
So V naught by V is absent, or is supposed to be small?
I'm sorry?
Well, this looks a bit like Navier-Stokes without...
And this is what, so this is in a sense related to what Jim Langer was asking, so there's no kinematic nonlinearity allowed, right? So we're assuming small deformations, okay, which may or may not be a good assumption if we want to understand, you know, bodies that are actually not, you know, constrained to small deformations. Okay, and so what you see in models like this, if you're shearing at different rates, if you shear, if you start from an ordered state, as you go over a stress peak and come back down, you eventually flow at some stress, and you see something very similar to what we see in molecular simulations. You see these transiently localized slip bands where the material slips. Then eventually, because of the noise, these slips go to a different region of the material. So something that I think is cute that Onuki did is instead of starting from a completely homogeneous state, what he did is he seeded his homogeneous material with some slips. Okay, so he put a pattern of 1, 2, 3, 4 slips. On the top, he put a line of, sorry, wrong way, a line of these transformations, right? So shearing in the epsilon 3 direction, which means I'm extending along this diagonal, I'm compressing along that diagonal. So he put a line of those guys on the top of his material, and he put a line of those guys on this side. And if you think about what it does when you line up a bunch of transformations that look like this, you end up with something that looks like a pair of edge dislocations, and there's a vorticity associated with the slip line that is clockwise. So you call this a C slip for clockwise. Then if you look at the other side over here, you have those same transformations, but now they're lined up vertically rather than horizontally. So if you ask about with this dislocation dipole, what is the sense of the vorticity associated with one of those guys? It's counterclockwise, right? So you can sort of pick that out. If I go around here, imagine these guys are slipping up, those guys are slipping down. So as I do a circuit over here, I come back to a displacement that points downwards. Okay, and so then a counterclockwise line of slip over here and a clockwise line of slip over there. And then he loads the system. I'm sorry, I'm missing an arrow. So imagine that I have the bottom fixed and I'm driving the top to the right. And what happens is that the two slips that are in a favorable configuration, initially, so if I look at the interactions between these pairs of dislocations here, these guys are going to be attractive. These guys are going to be attractive. These guys are going to be repulsive. Okay. But as I load, I'm going to tilt this potential energy landscape, and I'm going to favor the extension of these guys. This guy's going to want to go this way, this guy's going to want to go that way, this guy's going to want to go this way, this guy's going to want to go that way, and these guys are going to, this slip line is going to want to collapse, this slip line is going to want to collapse when I load it like this, and in fact that's what you see happening. So these two slip lines vanish because they're in the wrong sense for the strain that I'm applying. But these two that are favored grow. And what they do is they block when they run into each other. And so this lock right here ends up being a source for slip. Yeah, sorry, question, go.
This initial configuration, if you make a contour around the whole system,
yeah,
is there a net Burgers vector?
No.
Can you tell us what the function fun was? If phi was periodic, this would be a
model
for
Martensites,
right?
So phi is periodic. I think if phi had some global convexity, then it would be model for Martensites, right? So the point is that here I can. I didn't explain. So in Onuki, I basically tiled Onuki's figure. So the figure that appeared in Onuki's plot in paper was this. And so really, it's extended periodically. So you can any site in the material can transform any number of times. Okay. And so this is something that would be different than in a Martin Siddick kind of model, where you would be able to transform once and only once. Right. Okay. So yeah, I'm sorry. That's an important point. Phi is periodic. In the same spirit of Bulatov and Argon, right? So this is a continuous version of Bulatov and Argon. Okay, so the point is that once you see that these two slips, these guys lock up here, and this lock becomes then a source for slip later on in the simulation. Okay, and this state eventually becomes disordered and glassy, and it's difficult to differentiate this between an initially disordered state and this thing that he puts in with two slips. Okay, so that was just a flavor of the kinds of stuff that you can get out of Onuki's framework. And so now we come to our friend Monsieur Vandenbroek. This is the Barre and Palamali model. And this is essentially an automaton where I'm going back to the Bulatov and Argon framework. I keep track of discrete plastic events, right, and I can count those. So I say explicit Eshelby with a caveat. So the elastic propagator here, first of all, unlike Bulatov and Argon, now I'm thinking of a periodic system. Okay, we have to figure out how to construct the elastic response from a local plastic event with periodic boundary conditions. There are some technicalities there. So what they do in this model is they take only the far field piece of the Eshelby solution. And what they do is they go to Fourier space, they discretize, and they truncate after some number of terms in Fourier space to get the propagator. So this is what the propagator looks like in Fourier space. This is what the propagator looks like in real space. So this is what this function is. This is the stress increase on a remote site in the material due to a unit plastic strain at the origin. And there are some questions that I don't want to go into now, since this is a discussion, we'll make this an issue for the discussion. There are some issues about the precise way that this thing is discretized and how it affects the behavior of the model, especially in the transient and in the shear localized regimes. So there is one and only one kind of plastic strain that can happen. In the Bulatov and the Onuki model so far, we've seen these six different things that could happen. Here, there's only one kind of flip that's allowed, okay? And it's always aligned with the global shear that I want to impose. And the dynamics, so first of all, the thresholds are redrawn, okay? So this is a little bit different than Bulatov and Argon. Bulatov and Argon, and this was something Jörg was asking about. In Bulatov and Argon, I have these strains. The strains are pre-tabulated. There's only six different values here. And for every stress, if I want to know what the barrier is, I have to multiply the stress by that strain, okay? The so-called transformation strain. Whereas in the equivalent thing that's done here is a threshold is picked from some distribution, right? And so each site will yield with probability one after it hits that threshold, okay? And once a site yields, a new threshold is drawn from the distribution. So this is something that I think is very different in spirit from the Bulatov and Argon kind of model. And so the dynamics is extreme, and what this means effectively is that the global loading is adjusted so that I always have one site that's just at its threshold, right? So what happens is I basically go through and I prune, I pick off the weakest site in the material, and I can imagine adjusting my load until I recompute the stresses, I readjust the load until the next site is just at threshold. I let it undergo plastic transformation. I recompute the stresses. I readjust the global loading until the next site is just at threshold, and so on and so forth. And just to give you an idea about what these models can do, I think this is pretty an amazing. I think in the paper you guys say it's a striking agreement between these two. So this is what you get. This is some data from me some work that I did with Mark Robbins. In a large 2D Leonard Jones glass, shearing it very slowly with molecular dynamics. And I'm plotting the vorticity of the displacement computed over a time window that corresponds to 4% applied strain. Okay. For reasons that I don't want to get into now, this system is effectively four times smaller. I'm assuming that you can make a direct correspondence between the elements in the grid in a model like Damien's, and the atoms in an MD simulation like mine. But if you can make that correspondence in a system that's four times smaller, I should be looking at a strain window that's four times smaller. And in that strain window that's four times smaller, so I'm at 1% instead of 4%, the patterns look strikingly similar. So if you do detailed analysis, yeah, sorry?
The same quantity, other than what is
given? It's not the same quantity, but there's some unpublished stuff that I did briefly with Damien's PhD student, where we actually took the vorticity that you would infer from this plasticity, and the vorticity looks, I can't tell the difference between the MD and the lattice model.
Yes.
I don't want to go into it, and this is something that's a little bit confusing. Let's save it. I'll get through the models, then let's open up for discussion.
Yeah. Was your MD real MD or was it
AQS? This is real MD. Real MD at zero temperature, if you can call that real MD. So there's a constant viscosity. But we're going at a finite rate, right? And that the time scale that you can use to measure that rate comes from the drag on the particles. Okay. Okay, and then the last, well, there are two flavors left, but the last one that I want to get into any kind of detail on. This is a model from Hagla, which has been a little more well-cited in this community than Onuki's model, but I think still probably doesn't get the attention that it deserves. And it feels very much like Onuki's model with some key differences, okay? So where Onuki was focusing on displacements, those were the sort of principal degrees of freedom, and the forces on the nodes came from strains that were computed by finite difference on the lattice. Here, the strains are sort of the primary ingredient. And then there's a compatibility condition on the strains, right? That means these strains must have been derived from some single-valued displacement field, okay? But that's put in as a side condition in the dynamics. The strains are they're the primary actor. And so now, where Onuki had a fixed and regular free energy landscape as a function of the local strains, what Hagla does is he superimposes, so this is the same, if you go back to the Onuki picture, so this is the local free energy as a function of the diagonal strain and the axial strain. You do the same thing for Hagla. This is the local free energy as a function of the diagonal strain and the axial strain. And he pre-selects by choosing a bunch of waves with random frequency and phase in this plane. He pre-selects that energy landscape for the local strain to live in, right? So instead of having six different possible transitions with the same effective barrier, we have many, many, many. Effectively, you know, I can keep straining one of these sites forever, and each different well that I live in, I'm subjected. To a different possible number of transitions with different barriers. Okay, so I have a complex landscape, but that's pre-selected and there's no redrawing during the run of the simulation. And so, is that all clear? What he does, he has an overdamped Langevin dynamic. So Onuki had inertia, Hagla doesn't. Does it matter? That's something that we should discuss at the end. You might not be able to see this, but this is just saying, so the time derivative of the local strain is equal to some viscosity times the elastic stress plus some Lagrange multiplier lambda that enforces the compatibility condition. Okay, so this is how the strains talk to each other and they know about elasticity is through this Lagrange multiplier. And now if we think about the new ingredient that Hagla put in, that may or may not be related to the ideas that Jean-Louis and Elizabeth were talking about yesterday in terms of stress diffusion. So they put in stress diffusion, or Hagla puts in stress diffusion in an interesting way. What he does is he says, well, I can shift locally. What I'm going to do is I'm going to allow a shift in local values of the strain at any site. Okay, so I'm going to shift the local strain by epsilon naught. And then I'm going to evolve epsilon naught according to a diffusion equation. So this is basically a diffusion equation based on the stress, right? So he's letting stress diffuse in the system at some rate lambda. And the key point is that he's not subjecting these epsilon naughts to the compatibility condition, but he is subjecting the overall strains to the compatibility condition. Okay, so what you're doing is locally, you're monkeying with the stress field, you're monkeying with the barriers that these sites feel, okay, without affecting the actual displacements from which the strains were derived. So is that legitimate? Is that a legitimate physical mechanism for how stress relaxes in these systems? I don't know, but this is an ingredient of the model. And so because of this stress relaxation, the system will spontaneously age, even when you're not pushing on it, okay? And there will be rate effects that compete. So the time scale from the viscosity will compete with the time scale for stress diffusion. And so if you shear quickly, you're not giving time for the stress to relax. And you can imagine by shearing quickly, you develop strongly localized features. Or by allowing the system to age for some time, letting the stress relax before I start to shear, you might get localization of shear, right? So that's what they see. So these are basically four different pictures of the strain field. I think these are four different rates, not four different waiting times. But so this is for a fast rate where we're not allowing the stress to diffuse, and for a slower and slower and slower rate where finally the stress is diffusing and you have strong localization. So this is supposed to be discussion, and I'd like to open it up for discussion. This is the strain. Strain, not velocity. Okay. Yeah, but this is not the velocity, it's the strain. It's the time derivative of the strain.
Yeah, the time derivative of the strain is the velocity.
No. It's a strain rate.
Yeah, the strain rate.
I mean, I could write this as a velocity gradient. Okay. And so in the model by Azuri and Bouquet and co-workers Picard and Tristan Martins, which many of you in the room are working on this model now, so it's similar in spirit to the Barre model in the sense that there's a threshold, and something happens when you hit the threshold. Okay, but there are some important differences. So the threshold stresses are uniform. They're not distributed like in the Barre model. The yielding events occur stochastically in time. So what this means, at least in versions of the model that existed last time I looked carefully, the literature, Jean-Louis, I'm sure, can correct me. I think there are more recent changes. But what happens is once a site goes over threshold, you activate some Poisson process with some rate, and then that site will yield with some probability in time. But once it yields instantaneously and it redistributes its stress across the whole system. Okay, so I think there are newer versions of that model and that. Okay. So that those conditions have been relaxed a little bit. I'm prompting executives. So if you have more information about what's going on, feel free to speak up. I walked us through the different kinds of ingredients that I think are important and these five different flavors of models. And to me, the key points are, how do we describe the degrees of freedom? Is it continuous, or do we have something like an automaton? And I think this is important because, and this is really, I think, not been picked up on by anyone. And this is, if I had, one other PhD student, this is the very next thing that I would start working on. Mm-hmm. So trying to connect these things to the elasticity. So I think I'm afraid that we've thrown out the baby with the bathwater when we're neglecting the elastic fluctuations and all this stuff on plasticity, right? There should be very strong connections between the soft spots, like Jörg was talking about, and where things yield. And in models where you have discrete integer degrees of freedom for plastic strain, this isn't natural to think of softening and elasticity. But in models like Onuki's model and Hagla's model, it's there, right? So they may not have looked for it, but we should go back and look and see what's going on to the elasticity as these systems evolve into the local plastic strains. So that's point number one. Point number two, the number of possible transitions, is this important or not? So we have sort of extreme range here in the Barre Picard kinds of models. A site can only yield in one way, right? In the Bulatov and Argon and the Onuki kinds of models, you have some small number of possible things that a site can do. And in the Hagla model, a site can do anything, right? There are many different things that a site could do depending on where it is in that complex landscape. And so is this important for what emerges? And then the dynamics, do we have, the disorder that we put in, is it dynamically evolving, or do we put in some quench disorder? Is that important? How do we drive the system? So I don't know if it's important that in the Onuki and Hagla models you're putting a Langevin forcing on the stress rather than on the force. It may or may not be. And then the form of the drag, how we're damping things, and we heard from Mark Robbins in the conference, inertia can be very important for trying to figure out which. Yeah, Chen Wei.
I don't think I agree with infinity of hard
drag. Yeah, yeah.
It's six.
So in some sense the barriers are renewed, and every time you make a transition the site is subject to a different set of barriers. So
the local landscape,
it has a few saddle points. That's right. But there might, but you might have many small irrelevant transitions that you make, right? Or a couple, you could become stuck, right? Sites might become pinned in a very high barrier. It's certainly different than the other three. Yeah, I'm sorry, than the other two. But n equals infinity might be a little, Yeah.
When you mentioned the necessity
of building in the cloud models and soft spots, do you think in
terms of structure and mechanical engineering?
Yes, I do. So what happens in these...
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you mean in the Hagla sense, or no?
I think also in some version of
But so what I mean, so just so I'm clear, So if I have a continuous landscape like this, right, I've written down a continuous free energy function. If I take one of the sites in my lattice and I, by hand, I go in and I push it over the barrier, right? So I take this, I take that square, I make it a rhomb. I let the system come back to mechanical equilibrium, right? And then I advance and I strain the system externally and I ask, when will the site go unstable and make its next transition? This is something like a Pyrrhus barrier. And there will be some kind of saddle node bifurcation that happens, right? And so this is very similar to what we see in MD. And I'm sure that the sites with low effective, effective barriers are also going to be floppy. They have to be, because they're going to be on very, the tangent modulus is going to be very close to zero on the landscape there. Right? And so I think this is something that, we as a community need to take very seriously in trying to make a connection between the elasticity and the plasticity. And that will require going to these models where you have a continuous degree of freedom. I know for you guys who spend a lot of time optimizing on GPUs for the automata where you have integer degrees of freedom, it's tough news, but I think that's what we should be shooting for. And there are some issues that I didn't get into about how you discretize the elasticity. These may or may not be important. I want to just put that as a bullet point in case people want to bring it up in discussion. And my bottom line is what is it that we're trying to get out of these mesoscale models, right? So I think sometimes they're constructed specifically because someone has a particular mean field theory in mind, and they want to see what is some discrete model that will give me the mean field theory that I wrote down. On the other hand, if you want to try to write down one of these models that's mimicking something that's really going on in an experiment or a molecular simulation, do you need the model, or should you just jump to the mean field? Do you need the mesoscopic model, or should you just jump to the mean field kind of analysis, like, for instance, in a fluidity kind of framework? So those are the questions I have. So this wasn't, none of this was my stuff. This was not a talk. It was meant to sort of stimulate you guys to start asking questions and figuring out where we as a community should be going with these kinds of models. So here are the bullet points. One of the, I showed some of my data. I'm fond of that picture. And I was, it is striking how closely it resembles probably what I think is the simplest of any of these models, which is Damien's model.
Yeah.
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 Right? You get a lot out of that model that you see in the MV simulations.
There's one point to what Mark Pino is that some of these models have like a letter of Argo explicitly for the activation program.
Yes. Yeah, so that's what I was saying before. So yes, yeah. So the Bulletproof model in some sense is like the SGR model. Everything is activated. Whereas some of the other models, you know, the Extremal model is certainly more like the Eberle-Queux, where if I'm over threshold, I'm over threshold and something happens, right? And so I think that's probably an important ingredient. So in my youth, when I was talking somewhat seriously with Vasily Bulletproof about these issues, I was trying to explain to him that in the physical systems that I was thinking about at the time, which were dense emulsions beyond the ground closed packing limit, they were really athermal. So it's hard for me to imagine to make a precise connection between a kinetic Monte Carlo setup where everything is hopping to something that's athermal where nothing happens unless you drive it over threshold. Right? So I think that's an important difference. And I think Elizabeth and company are working on ways of trying to merge these two ideas and try to figure out what you get with activation and what you get with thresholds, right? So I don't know. Do you want to comment? Anyone want to comment on that? But yeah, I think that's one of the key differences among these five, right? So which are intrinsically activated and which have a threshold?
I'm not sure. Talking about this criticism, you agree? Paper in which I've seen this version explicitly as being incorporated in the paper by Kudrykis in September.
Yeah, yes.
We have two ways of discretizing. Mm-hmm. It seems to get quite different presents from the distribution of analogies.
That's right.
Other people, like, for example, you say typically the Kudrykis things is a little bit like doing the dynamical finite elements, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's a mesh, but it's just a square mesh.
I mean, I think the Onuki thing is one step away from molecular dynamics, right? So it's very, you're not abstracting very much away from the actual microscopic
mesh
model.
Is different from the one that Bulletproof is using, yeah. Which is a triangular mesh.
Mm-hmm.
This doesn't seem to make a major difference.
I would say that the way elasticity is discretized in Onuki's model is very natural. Like you say, it's like a finite element kind of discretization, right? Whereas in these other models, you have to make that choice. There's an earlier version, so in the model by Barre, which is, I don't think I have any pictures here, but let me write on the board. And so this is a 2D antiplane, so I've got it's a 2D system. And so I'm driving it anti-plane. So you can imagine each of these objects is a long column that has some resistance with its neighboring columns. And I'm trying to pull these top columns out of the stack. So here. And so I know this only because I had discussions with Damien. I don't know if it's in the paper, if it's explicitly described how the propagator was computed here. But there really was a force dipole that was introduced onto the lattice with those boundary conditions. And the response to that force dipole was used for the stress propagator, right? Which is...
In that case, elasticity is just Cartesian. So it's very easy to solve.
Yeah.
You can study numerical situation.
But what you do is you take the Laplace operator on the mesh, right? And you look at the Green's function for the Laplace operator discretized on the mesh, which is different than if you just write in free space. You write the Fourier expression, you take the 1 over k squared, and then you discretize after some number of grid points in Fourier space, right? So this is certainly, so taking the Laplace operator, putting it on a grid, discretizing, and then finding the Green's function, I think is the right way to go. And is very in spirit is very similar to what Onuki has done. And so it should, in principle, be possible. And this is something that Damien and I have talked about. It should be possible, in principle, to compute the propagator in the same way for their model as in Onuki's model, right? By putting the Lamé-Navier operator on a mesh, taking the Lamé-Navier operator, discretizing it, and finding its Green's function on the mesh. right, in a finite system with a with periodic boundaries.
In that case, is the mesh size just a trick that you could just reduce and check it if you, as you said, the way you do it in real space discretize or do it in Fourier space and you take points, then you think that if you discretize just with the finite mesh, you can get the same results.
So I
have the mesh size another physical mean in those models that you can't allow to reduce it so that you check the robustness of the results?
So I'll say one thing and then I'll defer to the experts. So. Okay, so certainly the physical picture that Bulatov and Argon had in mind when they wrote down this model, right, was that you had a finite region that underwent a plastic shear transformation, and it was sort of in intimate contact with its neighbors, right? They took the boundary value problem very seriously to figure out what the stresses were that were induced on the immediate neighbors, okay? Now, when you do something, and that's, I think that's similar in spirit to what you would get for free in a model like this, right? If you discretize you basically have to discretize this equation in a natural way on that mesh, right? And now, when you do this, I'm having trouble understanding physically what you're saying about where you believe the zones live, and so maybe, you know, Damien or one of the other experts in the audience who actually does this stuff.
Maybe we can.
Yeah.
This kind of model is very, very similar to deepening models. Basically, instead of thinking about your material sharing, you can consider that the plastic strain is living in an extra dimension orthogonal to the manifold, and you just have a manifold that advances in a either uniform or in another downstream. In that sense, when you take this kind of propagation, consider the long-range behavior, the power law that dominates at large scale. In a deepening spirit, you expect that this will get you the critical behavior, and that any change at local scale would not change too much the picture. However, when you go to, say, a localization, you will be surprised to be very sensitive to what happens at much smaller scale. And I think this is another way of formulating the question.
I come more from, say, microscopic models. So what would I miss if I would just take, for simplicity, a triangular lattice? Let's assume we are in two dimensions. Mm-hmm. I allow for dislocations, and I shear this material.
Are you allowing for, you know, when you say a triangular lattice, you allow large deformation, kinematic nonlinearity? Can I make a glass out of it?
Of course, even in equilibrium, there is a very nice theory for melting in two dimensions. Do I need also dislocations, disclinations in this? Is this something what happens here, or?
So the question is, can you get, is there the notion of disclination? That's a good question. So are we talking about the continuous flavors or the integer flavors? So should we think about the continuous? So the question is, is there a notion of something like a disclination? There's certainly the notion of a dislocation that you can put into these models, right? Now, does it matter?
I mean, this 2D melting transition is a two-step transition where you have first a dissociation of dislocation pairs and then of disclination pairs, and this destroys completely the order. And my question is, let's assume these are the degrees of freedom. I have dislocations, discriminations, elastic deformations. And of course, then I could imagine that I integrate out, let's assume dislocations are first important, I integrate out the elastic degrees of freedom, then I have essentially some kind of Peach-Köhler forces on my dislocations, dislocation interact. I mean, this may be extremely complicated. I only want to know, would I miss something if I would be able to do such a calculation in respect to what in these models is done?
I feel like you could get anything that you could get out of a molecular simulation. Somehow.
You treat dislocations as particles, which is essentially what people like Carmen Regan have been doing.
Good.
Then you get something which is very similar. The whole point here is that we do not have the local systems, we do not have dislocations, so we just have events of some sort.
But the latest part of the last 20 years of his career, Bulatov, as far as I know, since the last time I saw him, it was a specialist in dislocation dynamics, numerical simulations, models of dislocations.
I mean, in discrete dislocation simulations, you can't see unbinding of a pair. You can't give birth to a pair, right? Yeah.
Much too complicated.
Nothing related question to Thomas. We're discussing something which is about real solids, mm-hmm. which consists mm-hmm. from atoms.
Mm-hmm. Or particles.
Particles. Mm-hmm. Now, in all these models, the mesh size that you are talking about, mm-hmm. how big is it compared to atomic scales? So from what are your smallest scale you start with?
I would say that you just need something big enough to have the notion of strain, right? So several particles, 5x5 region of particles. It's a confusing question for me. It all comes back to what are we trying to do by going to these mesoscale models and then abstracting away from the actual particles? So if you look at what you get, if you compare an actual, MD simulation with real, quote unquote, real atoms, MD experiment, with what you get when you just have elementary things that flip. So this, the scale, this is 1,000 particles by 1,000 particles, and you get very strong shear localization at the level of a pair of particles sliding past each other, right? And so if I see these little flips over here, it's a grid that I've introduced, but you see long, skinny lines that are, adjacent along the diagonals of the cell of grid site, grid site, grid site, grid site, right? So in some sense, it's a one-to-one mapping. If I believe that in my particulate system, the strain is really localized to, adjacent pairs of atoms. I know there are probably people in this room that would argue with whether or not that's...
I think so the size of the grid cells is not very big in terms of... So the reduction in terms of number of degrees of freedom is not very high. It's maybe a factor of 10 to 100 or so. When you go from the particles to the more coherent matter. But now what you say is much simpler dynamics. So you save everything that relates to vibrations and this kind of stuff. So your time step, in a sense, will be larger. You can do things like kinetic Monte Carlo, which it's very difficult to do because you never identify what the transitions are.
But so I think, Jean-Louis, that's true of a few of these, right? So for the automata, that's true, where you're throwing out these sorts of details. But if you try to go to a description like Onuki's description, where you do have elastic waves propagating, and you do have continuous elasticity, and you can measure the local floppiness and relate that to where things make transitions, it's pretty close to the particle simulations. And so I'm confused spiritually about what you gain by going from the actual particulate description to a detailed mesoscale model like this.
Yeah. Can I make a conventional one?
Yeah.
Just
Would you like the mic so it's...
No.
Oh, you don't want it online?
No,
okay.
I don't want to talk into the mic.
Okay.
But look, this has been an approach that I, you know, personally, you know, I admire and I'm trying to follow what people are doing. But did you force me to go back almost 20 years to what Mike Falk and I were thinking about when we introduced these STZ theories, and which is still alive, I think, back in quite sure. And the question is, what's the difference in philosophy between them and what these kinds of models are doing? We started by looking at some of the ideas that Aligarnon had developed, flow defects, which he called shear transformation zones. One of the first questions that we asked was where do they come from? Now, what are they, how do they appear, how do they disappear, and what do they do? And how can we describe that in a statistical way? We looked at molecular dynamics simulations. Indeed, the very first ones that Mike did were at very, very low temperatures. And relatively small strain rates, not in the thermal quasi-station area, but they're very low strain rates, very low temperatures. And we wanted to make a theoretical picture that resembled what we were seeing in these molecular dynamics pictures. And what we could see was places. I mean, some sort of irregular system, quite disordered, but there were some kind of soft spots where these particles were making rearrangements. They were exchanging places with each other and therefore contributing to the shear. Now, what we didn't want to do, I don't know that we said this explicitly, but we didn't want to do what Argon and Willa talked about. We did not want to say that we knew in advance where these kinds of things were happening. We did not want to say that we were going to introduce an idea of viscous coefficients. We wanted somehow to see what the statistics of these soft regions were going to be, and get from first principles what the irreversible transitions were that were contributing both to the plastic strain and to the dissipative effects of the system. I just don't, this is a shortcut that tries to jump some of the questions that we perhaps were too ambitious in trying to ask, but I think that we're at a point now where we need to get back to that kind of question. I think that we've made some considerable progress in the statistical analysis of where these soft spots are likely to occur, in the statistical analysis of understanding what the state of disorder in these systems is. And a lot of the stuff that goes back, and I was very interested to see a couple of days ago when I reread the 1998 paper that we in fact even have derived the Herschel-Buckley law in the low temperatures. So we were not reading out elasticity, but yeah, the elastic effects were very definitely there. We did not and we knew that we should, that we were not, that we ought to put these formulas that my old friend Eshelby had done, and that we've never been forced to do that, but probably we should. And that all of those things are together. But I'm still very worried about these models where you put in by hand a viscosity, in other words, a dissipative effect. You put in by hand a distribution of yield stresses, of activation areas, instead of trying to derive some properties of the molecules that are involved in that. And you get interesting results out, but we should be beyond that.
So could you make a concise set of bullet points that lets us know which features of the STZ picture, right, as you originally envisioned it, are not compatible with describing one of these models. Because, so you know, I go back to my point here. You know, I feel like so STZ, as I understand, is supposed to operate at a you know, it's not a mesoscale model, right? It's supposed to operate at some kind of continuum level, right?
Well, it's supposed to be modeling. Some mesoscale model.
Yeah. So going from a particle scale model to something like STZ, yeah, versus going from something like a meso. So, you know, we heard yesterday from Elizabeth going from, you know, these various kinds of microscopic models to mean field versions of them. I don't see. So there are assumptions that you have to make in the molecular simulations. You have to put in a viscosity in the molecular simulations if you want to run at low temperature.
You put a thermostat.
Yeah. Okay. Or you put a viscosity, right? Depending on which kinds of systems you're thinking about. Okay. So. You know, my main question is which pieces do you think are not compatible of the main ingredients in STZ, which are,
I'm not sure which direction you want me to go.
Yeah.
I don't want to have to say that I have some fixed set of soft stuff.
Right.
In fact, I can show you, and this is a part of an ongoing discussion with Sellers and Case, that when you do that, as you do in SGR, you can mess up questions about how your this flow of energy entropy through the system is, especially during aging process. But you need, if you're going to do a fundamental theory, you need to be able to say, well, how do these soft spots occur? How often do they occur?
Sure.
That doesn't show up.
But there's what you put in and there's what you get out. And so it may be that the effective barriers, that the things that are relevant for an STZ-like description emerge in a more complicated way from the simple things that you stick in. I mean, the STZs of STZ theory may not be this simple set of, you know, this simple set of six elastic, inelastic transformations that the material can make. I mean, we might be talking about different, you know, could be apples and oranges. I would view these things as being no more or less serious than potential rearrangements that could happen at a very small scale in the particle packet.
No,